Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today in Silicon Valley, the long-awaited trial of former Theranos CEO Elizabeth Holmes gets underway with jury selection. The former one-time CEO of a $9 billion company is charged with defrauding investors and patients of the blood testing company that promised to revolutionize lab testing with a pinprick and a few drops of blood, but was later found to be a complete sham. In early 2020, I spoke with former Wall Street Journal and two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter John Carreyrou, whose reporting on Theranos raised serious doubts about the claims of the company and the CEO, and was recounted in his 2018 book, Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. The book won the Financial Times Business Book of the Year, and Carreyrou's reporting on Holmes and Theranos won a Polk Award in financial journalism. We repeat the conversation today on Studio Tulsa. John Carreyrou, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Bad Blood tells the story of CEO Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. And really, this is an old story in a 21st century setting. A charismatic leader and person selling something that's too good to be true, and a willing audience ready to suspend disbelief. In this case, a medical device that could revolutionize blood testing. Tell us a little bit about Elizabeth Holmes and how she was able to build Theranos without being able to deliver any sort of working product.
Right. She was a 19-year-old sophomore when she dropped out of Stanford back in 2004 and launched her company. And she had this vision for a device. At first, it was a bracelet-like device that was going to take minute amount of your blood from your wrist and then diagnose whatever ailed you and administer the appropriate drug. And after a few months, she and her co-founder realized that this vision was actually more science fiction than reality. So they downgraded it to something they thought would be more realistic. But the common thread during those 12, 15 years of the company's existence is that her vision was always too ambitious for what they were able to actually do. They never were able to implement her vision. And the problem is that she never was willing to acknowledge to herself or to her investors, board members, to the public, that they failed in living up to her expectations and that they failed in implementing the vision. And so that led to a situation where come 2013, 14, 2015, she was still telling people that she had a technology that worked, that could do hundreds of tests off a pinprick of blood, a prick from the finger. And in fact, she had no such thing. She had several prototypes that had never really worked. The last one was called the Mini Lab. And so there was this big gap between what she was telling people and what the reality was. And ultimately, the gap grew bigger and bigger, and the gap amounted to fraud. And that's the reason why she's going to be tried.
Yeah. And this was not a matter of showing that this thing worked for investors or for potential clients. This was a device that was actually being used on the public for the last couple of years of this company's existence, taking blood and providing results that may or may not have any connection with reality.
Right. What they did is they were running out of money in late 2013, and she had also been telling Walgreens, her retail partner, that she had this product and then dragging her feet for years. So she felt under pressure to launch with a technology that wasn't ready. And what they did is they hacked a traditional blood analyzer made by the German company Siemens. They modified it to try to create this illusion that their technology worked. And then on the basis of that commercial launch, which was first in two Walgreens stores in Northern California in late 2013, and then in 40 more Walgreens stores in the Phoenix area in 2014, based on that launch, she went to investors and solicited more money and got about $800 million of funding thereafter. So that's where it became securities fraud. She went to investors in late 2013, early 2014, with the lie that she had a product that she had fine-tuned and that worked. And the money came pouring in. That's one part of the fraud. The other part of the fraud is that she lied to patients and to doctors and to the public. And Theranos, you know, returned to patients and doctors blood test results that were often faulty and wrong, causing all sorts of problems from, you know, misdiagnosis to wrong diagnoses. And it's important to note that, because that's going to be part of what's at stake at the trial. Prosecutors have charged Elizabeth and Sonny Balwani, her ex-boyfriend, who used to be the number two of the company, with not just securities fraud. They have also charged them with perpetrating a fraud on patients and doctors.
Right. Take us back to this big idea. The big idea was that this was not going to just test glucose or even cholesterol. This was going to do like the work of a whole blood routine that you would normally go to a lab to take a sizable amount of blood to test, right?
Right. The phrase that she used and that Theranos used on its website was the full range of laboratory tests, which usually is understood to mean several hundred. And on its menu, Theranos had about 250 tests. And so, yes, it was supposed to be much more than just one or two discrete tests. The problem is that her machine could not do all those tests. At best, the device that they had, one of the devices that they had was called the Edison, named after Thomas Edison, could do about six blood tests. And then they had the Siemens machine, which they modified and hacked, that they used for another 80 or 90 tests to try to maintain this illusion that their technology worked.
And in the meantime, they're talking with doctors that are looking at giving their patients, they're giving them like cancer drugs. And so this calls for very sensitive blood testing to test liver function, kidney function, and the like. And I mean, this could have been a real tragedy. Do we know if there were any deaths related to this?
I don't know. I can't say. I didn't come across any deaths in my reporting. I can't say with absolute certainty that no deaths were caused. I came across more than a dozen examples of people who had health scares because of erroneous blood test results. People, some of whom, you know, got on treatments that they didn't need, and then had their health altered by these unnecessary treatments. But the thing to remember is that this experimentation on patients was thankfully stopped still in its early days, because when I came along and my story was published in October, my first investigative piece on Theranos was published in mid-October of 2015, they had only rolled out the partnership with Walgreens in about 42 stores, two in California and another 40 in the Phoenix area. And the plan, the next step of the partnership, was to expand the partnership nationally to Walgreens' 8,000 other stores across the country. Thankfully, that did not happen. You can imagine what a disaster that would have been.
Now, how does a Stanford sophomore dropout, chemical engineer, who comes up with this big idea, I guess this is just not a new story in Silicon Valley, so she was able to attract capital to her idea pretty early?
Right. Early on, she was able to get a million-dollar check from Tim Draper, who was kind of a friend of the family. Her family had lived next door to Tim Draper, who's a well-known Silicon Valley venture capitalist. In the late 80s, early 90s, she had befriended Tim Draper's daughter. And when she dropped out of Stanford some years later, she was able to approach him and get a million-dollar check. And then once Draper was on board, it became a little bit easier to get other people to give her money too. Another person that she was able to charm early on and wow with sort of her precociousness was Don Lucas, who's a well-known Silicon Valley venture capitalist who groomed Larry Ellison for a while, was the chairman of the board of Oracle, helped Larry Ellison take Oracle public back in the 80s. And when Don Lucas met Elizabeth Holmes, he thought he had met the second coming of Larry Ellison, except as a woman. So she benefited from these big, bold names early on. And then the point at which she really raised the most money is about a decade into the life of the company, when she was actually running out of money, and she decided to go live with what was essentially a fake product. And then based on the fact that the product was live, that it was available in Walgreens stores, she was able to solicit $800 million more dollars in funding from the likes of Betsy DeVos, our Secretary of Education, from the likes of members of the Walton family, from the likes of Rupert Murdoch, who, by the way, controls the parent company of the Wall Street Journal.
Right, and I think there was at some point an effort to convince Rupert Murdoch to intervene on your stories, right?
That's right. She met with Murdoch several times and tried to prevail on him to halt my investigation, and thankfully he did not.
So obviously Elizabeth Holmes was a very charismatic salesperson in selling this idea, but I guess it's the idea of itself that really interested investors. This, you know, how many times do we have to stop what we're doing, go to a lab to have blood drawn? It's never a quick and easy process. It's pain, you know, can have pain involved. And the idea of just a little pinprick that would tell your doctor this information, this was an appealing idea to a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a very seductive idea. The idea that you could get just a blood or two pricked from your finger, relatively painless and user-friendly, and then get fast results. The guaranteed results within a few hours. And in fact, her pitch was that because the process was so painless and user-friendly, patients would get their blood tested more often than they did currently. And as a result, illnesses would get diagnosed earlier and lives would be saved because those illnesses would be treated at an earlier stage. And so she often spoke about saving lives with her technology. And anytime you're telling the public and investors, for that matter, that you're going to be saving lives with a brand new product, that's a powerful pitch.
And there was also another element that you write about, is that tech wanted her to succeed, to be a female mogul that had built their own company, a female Bill Gates, a Steve Jobs.
Absolutely. There was this yearning in Silicon Valley for a woman to succeed on the scale that these men had, the Steve Jobses, the Bill Gateses, Larry Ellison, the Larry Page, Sergey Brin, and Mark Zuckerberg. You'll notice all those guys were guys. And this was going to be the first woman to succeed on their level and to become as wealthy as they were. The highest valuation for Theranos was reached in 2015, and it was $10 billion. And Elizabeth Holmes had managed to keep half of the equity in the company, so she was worth about $5 billion. She was going to be the first woman, self-made female tech billionaire. And all of Silicon Valley was rooting for her, and I think this was much larger than Silicon Valley. You had women all over the country and the world rooting for her. You had little girls writing her letters and emails. And it was really inspiring that she was going to burst through that glass ceiling in Silicon Valley.
My guest today is John Carreyrou, a 20-year veteran reporter for the Wall Street Journal, won the Pulitzer Prize two times, and his reporting on Theranos won a Polk Award and resulted in the book Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. It's now out in softcover by Vintage Paperbacks, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. As much as it was a story of her selling this technology that doesn't work, it's also a story of a board who doesn't do their job. The warning signs were already in place in 2006 when the first CFO just is one day there and one day gone, and that comes after a trip to Switzerland to talk about this product, and it doesn't work, and there's, you know, excuses made. But the turnover at the company was rampant. Board members who questioned the rosy financial projections, the production delays, were told to resign. This is a story of a board who just really bought into this vision and into this leadership and didn't want to hear anything else.
Right. There were two moments in the early years of the company where people at the level of the board asked questions. One was in late 2007, when a pretty well-known Silicon Valley figure named Avi Tavanian, who had worked for a long time at Apple with Steve Jobs, he had retired, and he, in retirement, had been approached by a headhunting firm and had agreed to become a board member of Theranos. And within a year of sitting on that board, he realized that things were not right, and he tried to blow the whistle and tried to get the board to do something. And the chairman of the board at the time, Don Lucas, asked him to leave quietly. And then a few months later, about 6 months later, there was an employee who also tried to blow the whistle and raise alarm bells with the board. And he convinced the general counsel of the company at the time that things weren't right. And that those two people went together again to the chairman of the board, Don Lucas. And again, that was handled quietly. There was a brief moment where the board almost unseated her and put someone else as CEO, but she managed to turn the situation around and to persuade them not to do that. And then from that point forward, her credibility was never questioned again. And the latter years of the company, she assembled this unbelievable board with ex-statesmen like Henry Kissinger and George Shultz, who'd both been Secretary of State. Jim Mattis, former Secretary of Defense, was on that board. Sam Nunn, other big names who had had, you know, larger than life careers in government. But that was actually a red flag. Looking back, none of them really had any experience in medicine, and certainly no expertise in blood diagnostics. And so when you look back at board, which was impressive at first glance, was actually a big red flag.
No doctors, no medical researchers or experts, I assume, on the board.
That's right. No.
Yeah.
Well, and no women either, only men.
Now, what do you make of that?
I think that she, deep inside, I think she knew from an early stage that she was able to charm men, and she was able to get them to believe what she was saying, and that while she might get some women to also believe her, that there was a greater risk with women, and she didn't want to incur that risk. And so I think she stuck to men. She knew men were her audience. She had a way with men, and I'm not, you know, insinuating anything inappropriate, other than she was smart, attractive, young, really charismatic, and she managed to convince men, you know, that what she was telling them was true, and she managed to get them engaged, and she managed to get them to champion her.
As the story unfolds in the book, there's another red flag, at least to a reader, and that is the amount of secrecy at Theranos. The secrecy seems pretty excessive, where you have people coming to work on machines, but they can't see anything else in the lab. There was the use of lawsuits against anybody who suggested saying anything negative about the company, non-disclosure agreements. Now, I assume some of that's part of Silicon Valley, but was their secrecy excessive at Theranos?
Right. I mean, non-disclosure agreements are definitely common in Silicon Valley, and there is concern at all Silicon Valley companies, you know, about leaking, letting technology and patented information leak. But this was really taking it to a whole new level. And the reason was that, you know, part of it was a lie. And so I think Elizabeth and Sonny were as secretive as they were because they were trying to prevent the truth from getting out. And in fact, the truth, the fact that they weren't really using proprietary technology, that they had hacked another company's machine, that wasn't even known by most of the workforce inside the company. The only people who knew about those shenanigans were the people who worked in one of the lab rooms, and those people had to get you know, their fingerprint scans approved to get in those rooms, and anyone who wasn't approved for working in that one particular lab room didn't know that they were cheating with the laboratory instruments. So when my first story was published in late 2015, a lot of the 800 or might have been even 1,000 employees who worked for the company then, a lot of them thought that the journal's reporting was inaccurate and wrong because they didn't know the truth of what was going on in that lab room.
There's a term in Silicon Valley. It's known as vaporware. This seems like this was classic vaporware. But as you write in the book, Theranos was not a tech company. It was medical tech. What difference does that make in this story?
Well, it's a huge difference. The culture in Silicon Valley is to what they call, the verb they use is iterate, which is to say you put out a product even if it's not completely ready, and then and usually it's a software product or it's a smartphone app, and then you beam updates to it so that by the fifth or sixth it's pretty much perfected. And that culture, which is a software culture, has permeated Silicon Valley since the 70s, early 80s. The problem is that Elizabeth Holmes' company was a medical company more than it was company, and there was software in the device, but the important part of the device was medical instruments, and you can't iterate with a medical instrument because doctors and patients are going to be relying on it to make very important healthcare decisions, some of them life or death decisions, which is why the healthcare industry is the most regulated industry in the world. So the culture of iterating and of moving fast and of breaking things, which I think is a phrase we owe to Mark Zuckerberg, is not a culture that you want to espouse in the area of medicine.
Former Wall Street Journal investigative reporter John Carreyrou speaking with us in early 2020 about his book Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup, which documented the sham blood testing company Theranos and its CEO Elizabeth Holmes. Since the company's failure in 2018, Holmes and company president Sonny Balwani have faced fraud charges, and today Holmes goes to trial. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Mark Dara.
Gunshots boomed that clear November afternoon in Dallas in 1963, and John F. Kennedy, mortally wounded, crumpled onto the lap of his wife, the back of his head blown off. The president's limousine rushed to Parkland Hospital. Within minutes, our country's leader was pronounced dead. Several of the Texas women there in the emergency room asked the young widow whether she wished to change out of her stylish pink, but now blood-soaked dress. Mrs. Kennedy refused. She said, "I want them to see what they have done to Jack." Jackie Kennedy wore the dress the rest of the day. When Lyndon Johnson was sworn in as the next president on Air Force One before the trip back to Washington, Mrs. Kennedy stood by him in that same stained pink Chanel suit. At the time, many must have thought Jackie Kennedy's decision had been a hysterical reaction. Her generation prized good taste and sophistication, and Jacqueline Kennedy had been the most elegant of all presidents' wives. What other reason could there have been other than emotional irrationality? The reason, Mrs. Kennedy, an intelligent and strong woman, said. She wanted the world to see the obscenity of the president's murder and the theft of his life not be minimized by sanitized appearances. Tulsa has its own bloody dress. In June 1921, America's Black Wall Street lay in rubble. As many as 35 blocks of the African-American community had been destroyed. Scores of our citizens died in the worst racial violence in our country's history. Virtually none of the perpetrators ever faced justice. The economic and property losses were not covered by insurance or community remediation, and thousands of Northside Tulsans were left homeless or chose to simply leave town. The events of that early summer were not and have not been forgotten by those whose lives and legacies were forever marred. This is what Charles J. Barrett, adjunct general of the Oklahoma National Guard and the temporary military dictator of Tulsa, found when he arrived with troops to stop the violence. 25,000 whites, armed to the teeth, were ranging the city in utter and ruthless defiance of every concept of law and righteousness. A former mayor of Tulsa is quoted as saying in the aftermath that the rest of the United States must know that the real citizenship of Tulsa weeps at this unspeakable crime. And unspeakable it became. The economic and political leaders of the dominant culture, many of whom shared the same beliefs of the white mob, wanted the disaster and disgrace hidden and forgotten. Generations of Oklahoma school children learned our state's history without reference to the horrid tragedy. Tulsa changed out of its bloody dress and put on a different one to hide the obscenity of its violence and to minimize the destruction and loss by sanitized appearance. That forgetting is why I'm not an advocate for changing street and location names or taking down plaques and statues that bear the names or images of our racist predecessors, and am not in favor of turning the despicable events of the hot summer of 1921 into a tourist attraction. We all live with the consequences of an oppressive and racist past. As William Faulkner wrote, the past is never dead. It's not even past. The fires from our troubled history still smolder, though many do not smell the scents, turning Tulsa's killing fields into a safe playground for the wealthy and the worldly allows us to keep the gruesome cries of the past silent. It's another way of changing out of the bloody dress. To truly overcome our societal deformity and its injustice, we must journey through the malevolent dwellings and not drape them with anodyne disguise. In the past 20 years, signs honoring our military dead have grown more numerous on Oklahoma highways, marking bridges or stretches of road, a consequence of our country's senseless wars. I'd prefer seeing the names of our state's poets, artists, musicians, entertainers, and teachers. The roadside emblems, though, honor these service members' devotion to our country and serve as a reminder of those who have died in war. The signs prompt questions. Who was the soldier, really? What kind of life did they live and lose? How did they meet their deaths? Some days, the roadside markers prompt grief for the unachieved dreams, a consequence of the unspeakable loss of our young and brave. How many others have died without being remembered? These signs remind us not only of honor and dedication, but more importantly, of the gross reality of senseless war and its irredeemable destruction. Like the markers in the sidewalk of the Greenwood District, reminding us of a civilization destroyed and the lost lives, and the signposts of those perpetrators who still cast vile shadows, like a blood-splattered pink Chanel suit worn by a beautiful young president's widow.
Mark Dara is a local attorney and a contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.